he would push his office forward to undo the protections that have been put in place to try to protect these young people.
And finally, you're joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, where attorneys for the family of an African-American teenager who was shot dead by a city police officer have reached a more than $3 million settlement. It's about 19-year-old Tony Robinson, who was unarmed when Officer Matt Kenny forced his way into an apartment following a, quote, disturbance in 2015. He was shot, what was it, 7 times. Your response to this settlement that is, I believe, the largest in Madison?
It is the largest settlement, and I think we'll hear from the family later today about it. But this is a situation in which an enormous amount of force was used, even though the police said that force was justified. It really calls into question in Madison and cities across the country the use of force versus non-lethal force or non-lethal efforts to subdue individuals if there is an altercation or if there is a dispute. 7 shots fired is a significant amount. That settlement is a significant amount. I hope that that settlement means that there'll be more reforms to provide greater instruction and training for our police to make sure that there aren't
we're gonna have to leave it there.
Shootings.
Lisa Graves of the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Dance and Resist. Raise That Fist, a live broadcast dance party on February 25th at 8 p.m. at Open Signal, Portland Community Media Center. Dance and Resist, Raise That Fist will be a part of the Open Signal Open House event and will be the first broadcast of the new dance party television show featuring Kelly Danger of KBOO's Midnight Highway. This will be a space that is safe to dance for issues that we care about, self-care, and radical social change. Costumes are encouraged. Again, that's Dance and Resist, Raise That Fist, a live broadcast dance party on February 25th at 8 p.m. at Open Signal Portland Community Media Center. 2766 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board meeting will take place Tuesday, February 28th at 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Stand Together, a day of action workshop Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Stand Together is a day of workshops for people new to social and political action and for those upgrading their skills. Sessions include digital security, photography for action, strategic planning, nonviolent direct action, legal basics, know your rights, and more. Again, that's Stand Together, a day of action workshop, Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitary Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, good morning. I am Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It is my pleasure today to have L.A. Kaufman, who's the author of Direct Action, Protests, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. She has spent more than 30 years immersed in radical movements as a journalist, historian, organizer, and strategist. Her writing on grassroots activism and social movement history has been published in The Nation, The Progressive, Mother Jones, The Village Voice, and many other outlets. She served as executive editor for the radical theory journal Socialist Review and as an award-winning national political columnist for San Francisco Weekly. actively, focusing on dissent and activism. Kaufman was the mobilizing coordinator for the massive February 15, 2003 anti-war protest in New York City. She continued in this role through the years of major anti-war protests, including those that greeted the 2004 Republican National Convention. Welcome to the program, L.A. Kaufman.
Thank you so much for having me, Joanne.
Oh, I am so thrilled to be talking to you this morning. You must be the most popular person on the planet right now, because I believe everybody is trying to figure out how to participate in direct action that makes a difference. And let me just say, I love your book.
Thank you so much.
And what you've done is actually really taken me back in history, because I was thinking there's at least a couple of generations that doesn't even know about some of the movements you wrote about. And one of my favorites was ACT UP. Which I'll let you describe what that organization did and how they came to public prominence. But I'm so glad that you went there, because I think there's good models throughout history, as you've articulated in your book, about when direct action works and sometimes when it doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been thinking about this history for a very long time. This book was kind of a ridiculously long time in the making. I started it more than 25 years ago. I worked on it for not the entire time, but for many years, interviewing people, thinking about the history, thinking about the lessons of protests. And it's rather extraordinary that after all of that, it happens to come out now at a moment when so many people are grappling with those very same questions.
Yes.
You know, my shortest version is that protest works. You know, not that all protests work,
right,
but that movements that have used an array of tactics of nonviolent resistance have on the whole been more successful than movements that have decided to work purely within the established channels of political participation. So, you know, there's a lot of nuance then when you start looking at specifics. But, you know, ultimately the message that I have for the sprawling resistance movement that's emerging now is keep it up, because it works. And we're not going to win everything. We're not going to be able to hold back all of the assaults that are coming down the road by a long shot. But we can accomplish perhaps more than we imagine.
That is absolutely true. And I want you to know that you are listed as part of resistance strategy. So you're going to be at Powell's Books next Thursday?
That's right, a week from today.
At 7 p.m.?
That's right, at Powell's on Hawthorne.
Yes, at Powell's on Hawthorne. So that's an important distinction. And I was so thrilled to see you listed. Willamette Week has weekly listed a list of activities that people can get involved in. And they call it from slacktivism to activism.
Nice.
And so you are listed as one of the go-to places to get involved next Thursday at Powell's Books on Hawthorne.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so excited about coming to Portland.
Oh, we are excited about having you here. As we know, since Inauguration Day, protests have been happening all over the world, not just the United States, but all over the world, in opposition to this current administration. What are some of the lessons that you think we learn historically about appropriate responses during this time of, can I say it, chaos?
Right. Well, I think one thing is that chaos can be productive.
Mm.
And what I think our basic strategic move in this moment, our most important strategic move in this very beginning of this new presidency is to continue creating a crisis for the Trump administration. That's not going to be the strategy necessarily over the long run. But right now, what the protests have done, ranging from, you know, the massive turnout on January 21st for the women's marches to the incredible lightning quick responses that made thousands of people flood to airports when the Muslim ban was enacted, you know, to the incredible reception that many members of Congress are finding at their town hall meetings. All of these are keeping the Trump administration off balance, a little on the defensive, already getting them to scale back some of the measures they were hoping to make. I mean, we know what they've done is bad enough, but there's evidence that they were planning to roll out more executive orders with more aggressive wording on a quicker schedule than they have done.
Well,
so to some extent, in preventing harm, we're already succeeding, and we are certainly succeeding at creating, you know, an atmosphere in which it's very clear that every single move that this administration makes is going to be strongly, strongly contested.
Absolutely true. Now, what's interesting is in your first comment, you said nonviolent direct action. For me, that's a principle of how I organize. But there are some movements now who do not have at their core the philosophy around nonviolence. What can we learn from history around movements that are at their core nonviolent and those who aren't?
Right. Well, I suspect that from the vantage point of Portland, that question looms larger than it does in some other cities because, you know, on the whole, the overwhelming majority of protests in the United States are nonviolent according to the strictest standard, which is to say that they don't. And if you define nonviolence as not being violence against other human beings, then right. Almost nearly all of them are. But obviously, there are some places where particularly the tactic of property destruction has been used by some people. I've seen those tactics come and go. I've seen people use them over the years. It always provokes a very, very long debate. There's always kind of goes on to a degree that's kind of greater than the incident. I mean, usually these incidents, if you compare them to what happens after, like, a college basketball championship, right. You know, it's like a comparable level of rioting. Those don't lead to a million op-eds. I'm someone who thinks you don't have to embrace the whole moral philosophy behind nonviolence to see it as strategically the most effective choice in nearly all circumstances. To me, one of the biggest problems with choosing tactics that go outside a strict definition of nonviolence is the extent to which they invite and justify police repression of our movements. And the risk of police repression right now is very great. I mean, we saw on Inauguration Day in Washington, D.C., more than 200 people were arrested and given very, very serious felony charges that carry a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years for being in a crowd in which a handful of people broke a handful of windows.
Wow.
People saw that image of the burning limousine from Inauguration Day. That happened hours later after all those people were already in custody as one of those ways in which, you know, sometimes news accounts can lie without lying.
Yes,
if you've got
yes.
the image of the That's burning right. limousine next to the story about the arrests, you'd mm-hmm. think they were connected. But I saw the windows that were smashed. It was one Starbucks and one Bank of America. Mm. There are 200 people. I mean, there's no way that 200 people were involved in breaking those three windows.
That's right.
And it allowed a federal prosecutor, right? So the prosecutor mm-hmm. is someone who is taking, you know, who's directly in the line of command of our horrific new attorney general, Jeff Sessions, you know, showing this incredible prosecutorial overreach. You know, it's much harder to repress a movement in that way when you have people, you know, taking the streets using bold and disruptive tactics, which I think are appropriate in many contexts, but, you know, stopping short of damaging property.
Well, and my words are just all jumbled. L.A., tell me how that plays out when you put a racial dynamic in that conversation.
Well, I mean, when you put a racial dynamic in the conversation, there's no question that that movements that are either led by or mostly most of the participants are people of color, that the level of police response is across the board more repressive, more intense. The risk to people's well-being and safety in participating, you know, in the face of policing, is greater, and you know, so there's a I'm not quite sure where to take this. I mean, I think that many groups have chosen. One of the strategic reasons why groups have embraced nonviolence is to try to protect their safety.
Right.
You know, the question of safety when exercising your First Amendment rights is, you know, is sadly, you know, a more acute and pressing one for folks of color who are out in the streets. They are more likely to be targets of selective arrest, of more severe prosecution, and of physical violence.
Well, and I wanted to acknowledge just recently, I find it a bit ironic that ever since Inauguration Day, you won't be surprised, there have been protests pretty much every day in the city of Portland. However, what I found interesting is just on President's Day, there was an arrest of 15 people participating in what was a peaceful protest. But it took the picture of a white 68-year-old woman bloodied and battered by police violence and handcuffed on the front page of a local paper for the mayor's office to come out and say, we've got a problem with police being over aggressive when it comes to protesters. Mm-hmm. Now, as long as they were black and brown people that mm-hmm. were being brutalized, there was nothing. There was no word from City Hall. There was no outraged about how people exercising their rights were being treated. And so we have a new administration. We have people saying the right words, but we clearly see when white women protested in pink hats, the police came out and took pictures and posed mm-hmm. with them. When mm-hmm. people of color are protesting, they show up in riot gear. And so I think that there's fundamentally, when we talk safety, there's a fundamental difference in safety when you're people of color as compared to being white middle-class American.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. It's an old, sad story about America and about, you know, America's police forces. You know, the one theme I explore quite a bit in my book is there's a way in which direct action tactics for a whole period. There was a period in the late 1960s. When the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Power Movement, and you know, a range of Black radical movements turned away from classic nonviolence, some people were exploring forms of armed struggle. People were, you know, experimenting with a whole range of other tactics. And when that kind of backfired, and the incredible repression that met the movement, you know, left people kind of in a state of shock by the early 70s. There was a period in which you saw very few examples of movements of color using any of the tactics of nonviolent direct action, or when they did, opting for very carefully controlled arrest actions, you know, to minimize the risk to people's safety.
Right.
And so you had a whole period where it was it was not just white movements. It was like the whitest of white movements. Right. The anti-nuclear movement, which, you know, it really couldn't have been whiter than it was. It was, you know, Seacoast folks in New Hampshire. It was like rural New Hampshire and Quakers and peace activists, you know, developed a lot of the techniques and the organizing principles, called a lot of the actions, and did so in a way without naming their whiteness or seeing why others might be reluctant to embrace those tactics, kind of elevating. I remember, you know, kind of when I came of age politically, it was like a badge of honor if you got arrested. Like, you wanted to say how many times you'd been arrested.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Yes.
And not getting the racial privilege in that and what it means if you're then looking down on other movements for not using those tactics.
Yes.
Understanding
this.
I don't think the Gulf is as bad as it used to be, but there's real questions there that movements still have to grapple with, I think.
I think that's absolutely right. If you're just tuning in, I am speaking with L.A. Kaufman. She is the author of Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. You can see her in person at Powell's Books on Hawthorne next Thursday evening, starting at 7 p.m. And pick up a copy of this book, because it is a wonderful, it just really connects so many of the direct action movements from the 70s, well, actually from the 60s and before, up to Black Lives Matters and others. And so it's a really good analysis, I think, of kind of how some of these movements have been successful. Now, one of the things I liked about your book was you talked about you might not see the policy change right after the march. So you bring thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people into the street. You mean the next day Congress doesn't reconvene and say, hey, we should fix this?
Right, exactly. people. It's important for people to have appropriate expectations of how and when protests work, so they don't then go home and feel dejected. Because,
right.
You know, what do you know? We had, you know, millions of people out in the streets on January 21st, and on January 22nd, Donald Trump signed the global gag rule, which will, cause extensive harm to women all around the globe. You know, he wasn't deterred one bit by our protests. You know, and oftentimes the influence is something that you can't pin down, because it's what didn't happen that would have happened otherwise. So it's important to not think that protests are going to have sort of like a magic overnight concrete result that you can point to. That's not quite how it works.
Right. Absolutely true. And in fact, I think one of the criticisms of protests nowadays, and especially I think of Occupy Wall Street, one of the biggest criticisms was they didn't have an ask.
Right. Well, Occupy Wall Street was an unusual political creature. It was, this kind of incredible gathering of energy, but as you say, you know, there was a very deliberate decision not to have demands, not to to shape the movement into a kind of traditional political structure, but instead to use it more as I quote the name of a book about Occupy, which is Dreaming in Public, which I think captured really well what the goal was. That it was about, you know, opening up political space, opening up conversation, things that are, you know, very kind of elusive and hard, you know, not something you can pin down.
Right.
What I always say about Occupy, I was busy with other projects at the time and not particularly involved. And I always say that I'm really glad I missed it, and I'm really glad it happened.
Uh-huh.
That it was this kind of beautiful disaster. I mean, the meetings, the few that I went to and the ones I've observed or heard accounts, could just be excruciating, just going on and on forever.
Yes.
And
yes.
Never reaching any kind of decision. But there's a way in which that spoke to a deep need that a lot of people were feeling and helped reignite a sense of possibility. Mm-hmm. Occupy in itself, it was kind of short-lived. It was clunky. There were all kinds of internal problems. But it was so generative. So many things spun off from Occupy. It created so many projects that continue to this day, and then there's many other projects that weren't directly created out of Occupy, but that channeled some of that energy, and where there's real continuities of personnel. Black Lives Matter is one of those, So I think I understand why people found it very frustrating, and had I been there, I'm sure I would have too.
Mm.
But looking at it from the longer view, I think it actually accomplished some really beautiful political alchemy by making people dream in a way that they hadn't been doing for a while.
Yeah, I was very I had a lot of admiration for Occupy here in Portland because the creativity of the people involved. They fed 3,000 people hot meals 3 times a day. They had a school. They created ways to produce electricity by charging your phone with a bicycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
The creativity of and the community that showed up to really support Occupy, I thought was pretty phenomenal. And so, but I also agree with some of the criticism that without a clear ask, it's kind of hard to know if you're winning,
right.
If you don't actually know what you're asking for. I think one of the, let me ask you, has there been a time in our history where the political forces were so splintered, and we were at such risk of mass disruption in our day-to-day lives?
You mean as now?
Yeah, as now.
I mean, there's not been anything quite like this in my lifetime. I'm 52. But, I imagine earlier generations who lived through, some of the social cataclysms of the 30s during the Great Depression, or the periods when World War I and World War II might have felt a similar sense of fear and doom and of lives being turned upside down. There's no question that there's something uniquely awful happening right now, and I think that's why we're seeing such a uniquely powerful response. I'm really pleased to see that people are very much taking to heart that this is a moment to do more, to ask more of yourself, to participate more fully, to stretch, yourself on what you're willing to do. I think that the kind of resistance that we've seen so far, is likely to just continue to build. I think on the whole, people understand the gravity of this moment and that it's not, it's not going to be a month of protest and then everybody goes home. I think people are understanding that we're going to have to be a little more, a little tougher. Like, we have to toughen up and prepare to do this work over the long haul if we're to at least reduce the harm of what feel like, fundamentally existential threats right now.
Yes. Well, it's ironic because this week we just I participated in a remembrance around Executive Order 9066, which led to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And I can't help but connect the dots to know that in times of war, stupidity is like paramount. The thoughtful thinking that you expect from your political leadership doesn't quite happen. And what struck me, what I was reminded of, was that Executive Order 9066 never mentioned Japanese at all. It was, in fact, left up to the military commanders to determine who was impacted by this executive order. And I also want to remind our listeners that 62% of the Japanese that were interned were U.S. citizens. And so when you hear a president currently who speaks the kind of hate and bile against immigrants and refugees and others that aren't white men, you can't help but be extremely concerned that history could, in fact, repeat itself.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the scope of the deportation plans that have been announced are, you know, are just staggering. Just staggering the lives that they are hoping to disrupt. I mean, I just read a story overnight about a woman who was in ICE detention. Who had a brain tumor, and they pulled her out of the hospital in shackles and took her back to the ICE center. I mean,
whoa.
You know, the things that are being reported right now, you know, we do, you know, there's a way in which some Americans tell themselves a false story about our country's history, that,
yes.
You know, America is somehow a country, you know, founded on
freedom.
On freedom.
Yeah,
and goodness,
right.
And, and kindness.
Yes.
There are plenty of Americans who have a different perspective on that history. But you know that myth still. The only good thing about that myth is if we are shocked by atrocities and move to action.
Yes.
But you're absolutely right, Joanne, to point to the Japanese internment as one of numerous times in our country's past when. Terrible things came to pass, and not enough people stood up to oppose them.
Yeah, and you know, what was interesting about that time was that elected officials did not stand up to oppose it. Our courts did not stand up to oppose it. And so, again, it's up to the people to be prepared. And like you, I feel like there's a renewed sense of, oh my gosh, this isn't the country I thought I was living in. I've got to do something. And so people are struggling with what the it is that they need to do. And so your book, the timing is just so perfect because so it gives people kind of a lens to look through some of these movements in the past. What do you think would be one of the critical components of the movement today?
Well, when I look back at the movements of the past, you invoked ACT UP early on, and I'd like to talk about them a little bit because it's now been a long time ago. There are a lot of, you know, folks who are college age or in their early 20s who may not realize just how much ACT UP accomplished and
yes.
Under what circumstances.
Yes.
I mean, I think of ACT UP as being the single most effective single activist organization of the last 40 years. Because they can quite clearly take credit for having saved literally millions of lives. There are millions of people who would be dead from HIV who are living now.
That's right.
Now that it has, for many people, been turned into a chronic but manageable health condition instead of a nearly certain death sentence.
Yes.
And when they began fighting, there was, you know, there were no cures in the pipeline. Many members of the organization were themselves sick and dying. People were very literally fighting for their own lives.
Yes.
They did not have large numbers. And they were not popular. They weren't popular, and they didn't try to be popular. In fact, ACT UP was one of the most, you know, the rudest, most obnoxious groups you could imagine.
Yes.
They would scream, they would yell, they would disrupt. Their graphics were bold and often purposely offensive, shocking. You know, they were trying to shock people out of their complacency.
Yes.
You know, many people said, oh, they're going too far, or this is too rude, or of course we need to address this terrible disease, but this isn't the way. I mean, all the kinds of things that people say.
That's right.
But it worked. The combination of their willingness to be unpopular, their smart use of direct action tactics. They would go in and occupy government offices. They wouldn't just go to some random place. They were very targeted and smart and strategic about it. That and the way in which they educated themselves about the issue, so that they were able, when their protests got them meetings with key public officials, to sit down and say, look, this is how we think you need to change the drug testing protocols. We've looked at this very closely, and we have these very specific recommendations. That combination proved just incredibly powerful. As I said, it led to the accelerated approval of the class of drugs, protease inhibitors, that have saved millions of lives and would not have been available on that. I mean, they may have been eventually available, but not on anywhere near the timetable that ACT UP was able to accomplish. So I take a lot of lessons from that. Mm-hmm. That you know, it's important to get huge numbers in the street, but it's important more for us to make us feel a sense of our power, for us to build relationships within the movement. I think those mass mobilizations are often moments when movements are working out internal stuff, mm-hmm. which is often, because this is America, it's often working through questions, divisions of race and racism within the movement. It's often, you know, part of what happens when you bring people together in a mass mobilization. You work through some of those issues, but they aren't really pressure tactics. Pressure tactics are more focused, and usually it's a smaller number of people. I think we can take heart from that, because you can have, you know, a group in the hundreds that is dedicated and persistent accomplish much more than a mobilization of a million people that costs, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to put together.
Right.
And
it's just a one-day event
all across the country.
Right.
Yeah, and it's a one-day event, and then people go home.
Right. Well, we're going to go to the phone line. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to L.A. Kaufman, Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. And she will be at Powell's Books on Hawthorne next Thursday at 7 p.m. And we're going to who's on the line? Hello, Camilo. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Yes, indeed. It's time to let the people speak. I have news information about a rally protest and some commentary about...
Very quickly. Okay, come on.
The protest is going to be March 19th at 2 p.m. at 1455 Northwest Overton Street in front of the offices of Homeland Security and the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. There they have imprisoned Lady Liberty, and we are organizing a peaceful, nonviolent protest to go and rescue her. We are going to march from there two blocks to the Freedom Wall, where we will offer flowers to celebrate her release. And I want to just make a brief comment. I think one of the things that you have pointed out is that the language, the symbols of the founding principles of our nation have been distorted and co-opted. Republicans and conservatives love the terms and ideas embodied in that of liberty and freedom, but these concepts have been taken and turned to use against you to in effect encapture your mind, and we're going to free the use of these symbols and return them to their true meaning. So join us to rescue Lady Liberty, March 19th.
Thank you. Appreciate the call.
Oh, that's very nice. You may have seen that some other folks did their own version of Reclaiming Lady Liberty the day before yesterday when they hung a huge refugees welcome banner on the Statue of Liberty here in New York Harbor, not far from where I am now.
Yay.
So symbols, those political symbols have real power, and reclaiming them does as well.
Absolutely. We've got a couple of other callers. So good morning, Mitch. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having this discussion and inviting those who show up at the protests to participate. I'm a little concerned, Ms. Kaufman and Joanne, with the lack of what I see as traction of the activism that appears in the streets, and street theater is very effective, but that it doesn't show up on the pages and in cyberspace where it could. And that the loudest voices are actually the Yahoo voices that keep, accepting Trump being able to recreate a new enthusiasm for deregulation in finance, deregulation in pollution.
What do you mean it doesn't show up? What do you mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that.
Sure. Let's look at a business-friendly newspaper like the Pamplin Papers, who can reach people who don't already have our beliefs and our ideas. And they ran in Black History Month, as they could be predicted to do. They outsourced their investigative journalism to a nonprofit, and they ran a few articles in this month titled Unequal Justice. And when you look on the space made available in cyberspace on the Portland Tribune website for comment, or if you look at the current Willamette Week, which has a wonderful article by Rachel Monahan on our own Democratic Senator Ron Wyden, who is banging the Cold War drums slowly, rather than reinvestigating why the Democrats have been such a failure in representing these progressive ideas. What we find on their comment spaces online is that there is no one really taking the time to articulate an explanation of why people in their suburban safe redoubts should be alarmed at this undermining of American values. And I don't see them turning out. The people who turn out in numbers are the reactionaries.
Okay, I can tell you that you can bet anytime race is mentioned in an article, I avoid like the plague the comment section. Nothing good.
Wise woman.
Nothing good comes out of engaging with people around the issue of race, especially when they have the privilege of being anonymous, and you don't know who they really are. And so I can tell you, for me personally, I don't even, that's a losing game.
No, people have the choice to post with their names, and I always make it a point to put my name
I run a
media discussion list.
But we don't
see our side turning out.
Hello? I don't waste my time responding to comments online, because I'm actually talking to the people who are actually going to get in the street or get in the face of elected officials and organize a plan for change. Some people may want to spend time arguing with people online. That's not my work. And that's why I don't do it. LA, you want to comment?
Yeah, I don't think I agree with your premise, Mitch. I think people are showing up. I mean, I think what's happened in the town hall meetings around the country this week is just extraordinary. Have you ever seen so many kind of pissed off old white people?
Yes. I mean, it's not in my lifetime.
You know? And pissed off for the right reasons, right?
Yes.
Not pissed, you know,
Yes.
I mean, I start from the belief that we already have the majority. The other candidate won the popular vote, and when you take people who don't vote and put them into the equation, this is a president who, you know, does not enjoy the support of the majority of this country, and whose approval ratings keep going down
the more he
and
talks.
I think all kinds of people who don't normally show up, in that sense, are doing so now. You know, sometimes because they just figured out, oh yeah, actually the Obamacare is the same thing as the Affordable Care Act, and
right.
if it's repealed, I'm going to lose my health care.
Well, that's,
you know,
that's,
some of it's people coming a little late to these realizations, but I still see it happening.
But that's exactly what I mean. You've made my point, is that they come late because we haven't taken the time to deepen the understanding, and we depend on the media doing it, but the media is totally corporate captured.
Okay, thank
and
you.
And we don't avail ourselves of comments.
So we're going to move on a bit. I disagree with his premise. I think people were really much more some people were comfortable before the presidential election. I think we have not done an autopsy of why the Democrats lost what was theirs to win. And of course, we have to talk about voter suppression, voter intimidation across the country. We've got to talk about voting machines that don't necessarily record your vote as you voted with no paper trail. But that's not the conversation we're having today. The conversation today is really around direct action and pros and cons of direct action. Now, one of the questions that I have for you, LA, is really around it is becoming more and more dangerous to take to the street as protesters, because what we are seeing locally is a much more militarized approach when large groups of people gather. Are you having that experience in New York as well?
So far, we are not, but I've certainly lived through periods before when that's happened, and I know what it's like and how chilling it can be when you show up with, you know, a group of people to express your views on the streets, and there's a bunch of goons in paramilitary riot gear
yes.
standing there. You know, it's meant to intimidate, and it does.
And it does, yes.
You know, we have a funny thing. I live in New York City, and you know, our mayor is pretty progressive. You know, there's been a more respectful response to the protests in recent weeks in New York City than we have sometimes seen, and that partly may be resentment of the NYPD of having to keep defending, you know, protecting Trump Tower.
Right.
The burdens that this presidency, the special burdens that this presidency are placing on New York City's police and security apparatus. I think there have been a number of kind of crazy bills that have been considered in state legislatures around the country that would, codify more repressive policing. There's a
yes.
lot of worrisome signs on the horizon that that there will be, the kind of police repression that we've seen in some of the really toughest times in our history. You know, there was a whole period after 9/11 when you couldn't go to any protest without it being surrounded by, you know, everything was metal barricades and riot cops,
right.
And you know, there'd be like 20 of you with your peace signs, you know, surrounded by this wall of goons.
Well, and in fact, that was when the term free speech zone was created,
yeah,
right?
Where, yeah.
Right. And I certainly expect that to come back again in some new form. I guess for me, this is the first time in my lifetime that I've actually seen comfortable white middle class people be fearful. And not just fearful for their own safety and well-being, but really fearful for what's happening in their community and how it's playing out with other people who are being impacted by these outrageous laws and mandates coming from D.C. And so in this space, I think there is the potential to build a very multicultural, multiracial, multigenerational movement. But we must learn some lessons from last movements about when that's worked and when that hasn't worked well. Any advice as we hunker down over this next couple of years and really prepare for the fights that are coming?
Well, I think I think one really key piece of advice is the principle of following the leadership of the people who are most affected by a given issue.
Yes.
When you take that as an organizing principle in your politics, that grounds you, and it almost always makes for a movement that is more inclusive, one in which it's not comfortable white people determining the strategy, taking the leadership positions, being the spokespeople, you know, kind of dominating the political space. You know, it was, to my mind, a really promising and hopeful development, the way in which, with the Women's March, you know, it started as a couple of Facebook posts that got incredible attention, Facebook posts by a couple of white women who were alarmed by what was going on and wanted to take action, but who, you know, quickly were approached by some very seasoned women of color organizers who said, hey, wait a minute, if you're going to really do this in a way that is meaningful and broad, you have to step back and be open to an entirely different framing of what this protest is about, which you know, and ended up finding expression in the very beautiful platform that they ended up issuing for that march.
We had the same experience here in Oregon. We had some challenges at the beginning, and then the leadership changed and it became a more inclusive event. I think we have another caller on the line. Angela, good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a comment, and then after I heard the last call, I wanted to kind of bring up some of the issues you pointed out. I read in the paper that Tim, our mayor, Wheeler, said that he ran on a police accountability platform when he was running for mayor, and that's not true. I've been extremely disappointed with the way Wheeler has been managing protests.
He did run on a police reform platform. Yes, that's true.
Not that I recall. He seemed like he was toeing the line, trying to please minority voters, and while maintaining his view of, like, his terrible view of how police should run the city. I mean, he seems to believe in a lot of police control, and the legislature, Oregon legislature, recently, like, created a bill that would make protesting a felony if you were a college student.
Really?
And it's coming off of what Wheeler created. He increased violence towards protesters. I can't remember. I mean, he said that the police had, you know, the right to do whatever they had to do to calm protests. And after that, this bill came up. And so, I mean, he is leading Portland, and he's leading the civil rights of Oregon in the wrong direction. It's just, I mean, looking at it from a big picture perspective, that's what he's doing, and it's really scary, and I'm really disappointed. I don't remember him running on a police reform platform. He was just trying to please people. I mean, I didn't see anything he said as in police reform.
So if you go to his campaign,
stop.
Okay. If you went to his website, you would see that police reform was a central piece of his campaign. Having said that, I share your concerns about his lack of action when police are being aggressively heavy-handed only in protests that are being led by people of color. So now you may continue.
Okay, and then the last caller brought up the comment section in the Willamette Week and the Oregonian.
Yes.
And that, I mean, that is very, very relevant, because you can listen to KBOO all day and think, wow, Portland's very liberal and alternative, and then you go to the comment section of the Oregonian and the Willamette Week, and there's all these people that just say the most
vile
things,
yes,
about,
yes,
minorities,
yes,
just constantly, and it's clear that there's a lot of very conservative and right-wing people.
And trolls.
in Portland, and it's a concern that there are more just conservative people and biased people than liberal people commenting. That really says something. And
what does that say to you?
It says that there are a lot of conservative and biased people and racist people in Oregon.
But that's Oregon's history. Oregon's always been that way. Why are you surprised?
I work in social media, and so that how people interact online is really important. I know you two kind of disagree on that, but from a social media perspective, it's important. I mean, a lot of big movements have been created through social media, through Twitter, the support for Bernie Sanders, and in the Middle East, they've had I forget what they call it. But they've had a lot of movements that were created through Twitter and online. So how people interact online is important.
I agree. If you're going to be an activist, you got to actually listen as well as talk. Okay, so I agree with you that there is a generation that gets a lot of their information through social media, right? And so because of that, I think it's that generation's responsibility to respond when they see negative things in social media. I'm old. I don't spend a lot of time on social media, right? But for people who do, it is your responsibility to push back when you hear that racist right-wing ideology coming through. And so I would love to talk to you more because you are passionate about your perspective. Unfortunately, you've called in at the end of the show, but I hope you'll leave your number with my engineer so I can invite you because I love strong, opinionated women. I'm one myself, so love to talk to you some more.
Okay, I will.
Okay, very cool. Have a good day. Thank you for your passion. Thank you for whatever you're doing to make this world better. And so, L.A., I want to make sure once again we let folks know that you are going to be at Powell's next Thursday, and you're going to be there at 7 p.m., and it's Powell's on Hawthorne, and you're going to have your book, Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism, and maybe you'll even sign it for me.
I would be thrilled to do so.
Oh, I will be so thrilled to listen to you, to engage in the conversation with the community. Again, this is one of the most timely books on the planet right now. There's an old saying, and I can't remember who said it, those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. And so this is a very valuable book for us as we prepare. There's a lot that's going on, and we need to understand when direct action works and when it doesn't. Any last words from you, LA?
I would just say that we don't build broad movements by getting down on people for what they didn't do in the past. There's a lot of new people coming on, and maybe they didn't stand up as strongly as they should have, like when Obama was deporting people, for instance, or assassinating people with drones, or any of the other things that might have happened. But now is a moment when we need to be as welcoming as possible of everyone where they are, and try to encourage everyone to take one or two steps farther. That's how we're going to win.
LA, that is exactly the advice I'm giving over and over and over again. I am telling people to stop talking to the choir, go meet a new choir director, engage them in conversation, and be humble enough to accept that they're at the battle now. Right? Because shaming people because they weren't there a decade ago is not going to be useful in this time. I am so glad to hear you say that. You and I are sisters from another mother. I just know it. We've got the same kind of passion for this work. So we'll see you next week, Thursday, 7 p.m. at Powell's Books on Hawthorne Avenue. And again, thank you so much for writing such a timely book and really connecting the dots of so many of the movements. I think we will learn a lot from both reading your book and actually putting those practices into action. I am Joanne Hardesty. This has been Voices from the Edge. And we'll see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a fabulous day.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. A couple minutes in front of 9 o'clock on your Thursday. We've got Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia in 1 hour from now at 10 with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 today, it's Between the Covers, today welcoming Marnie Bates and her book Dial M for Murder, a tale of mayhem and murder at Starbucks. And at 11:30, The Film Show welcomes artists and organizers from the All-In Social Justice Film Series and the Cascade Festival of African Films, plus a new look at the micro-budget feature film Shut Up, Anthony. That's all coming up right after Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell with your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program. And that is coming right up here on The Boo.
You, I'm Kurt Cobain.
Yay.
When did you first hear punk rock?
You know, I wanted to hear punk rock forever. Of course, they didn't have it in our record shop in Aberdeen. Finally, Buzz Osborne made me a couple compilation tapes. And I was completely blown away. I would lip sync to those tapes and I wore them out and I play them every day. You know, it's the greatest thing. It expressed the way I felt socially and politically. And it was the anger that I felt, the alienation.
Be sure to tune in this Thursday, February 23rd, just before midnight, as we celebrate what would have been Kurt Cobain's 50th birthday. We'll be exploring all the music from each of the albums on his top 50 list. That's this Thursday, right before midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.